final investigator I met with was Dr. Michele Cavo, who provided an update of new research in multiple myeloma. And to begin, he commented on the evolution of trials evaluating new induction regimens in younger patients being considered for transplant.
At this time, patients who are candidates to receive an autologous stem cell transplantation should be treated with an induction therapy incorporating at least one novel agent. And at this time, we can basically divide induction regimens into those who are bortezomib-based, those who are IMID-based, and also a third class of regimens in which bortezomib and IMIDs are used together. What is clear at this time is that three-drug regimen is superior to a two-drug regimen in terms of higher rate of complete response or at least a very good partial response before autotransplant. And it is clear that the response is furtherly improved following autologous stem cell transplantation. And this shows that the incorporation of novel agent into a program of high-dose therapy and subsequent high-dose therapy with stem cell support are complementary since the rate of complete response furtherly increases after transplant. So at this time, the best induction regimen a younger transplant-eligible patient should receive is a three-drug regimen, and probably a three-drug regimen incorporating bortezomib and an IMID such as thalidomide or lenalidomide seems to offer the highest rate of CR before transplant.
What about the cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, dexamethasone?
As you know, both bortezomib and lenalidomide can be differently combined with many drugs. So I made you the example of a three-drug regimen incorporating bortezomib with an IMID. And this is based on the fact that this time we have at least the results of three phase 3 clinical trials, which have shown that a regimen incorporating bortezomib plus thalidomide and dexamethasone, that is VTD, is superior in comparison with either thalidomide dexamethasone or bortezomib dexamethasone. This is the proof that a three-drug regimen is superior over a two-drug regimen. However, as you correctly stated, bortezomib and also lenalidomide can be combined with a cytotoxic agent, such as, for example, cyclophosphamide or doxorubicin. At this time, we have data from phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trials in which these three drug regimens were compared with standard chemotherapy and not with a newer induction regimen. But I think that a three-drug regimen incorporating, for example, bortezomib or lenalidomide with the cyclophosphamide may be a good induction regimen in preparation for autologous stem cell transplantation. So the choice of the physician is quite large.
What about induction therapy in the older patient, the non-transplant situation?
As you know, at this time, we have two standards of care for transplant-ineligible myeloma patients. The first one is the combination of melphalan-prednisone with thalidomide, this MPT, and the second one is melphalan-prednisone combined with bortezomib, that is MPV. At last ASH meeting were reported the results of a preliminary analysis of an international study comparing standard melphalan prednisone with the same regimen combined with lenalidomide. And lenalidomide is used also as maintenance therapy. And results so far available show that melphalan prednisone plus lenalidomide, that is MPR, followed by lenalidomide as maintenance, improves significantly the clinical outcome in comparison with standard melphalan prednisone. This means that I think within a reasonable period of time, we will have a third standard of care, which is represented by MPR followed by lenalidomide maintenance. And this is another example of how maintenance therapy plays a role in both younger transplant-eligible patients who have received an autologous stem cell transplantation and in elderly non-transplant-eligible patients.
What about bortezomib and the non-transplant situation?
I think that one of the most important issues about bortezomib in non-transplant-eligible patients is backed by several studies showing that shifting from a twice-weekly administration of this drug to a once-weekly does not reduce the efficacy and lowers significantly the rate of neurological toxicity. This means that these patients are able to stay on therapy for a longer time period and to benefit from a prolonged exposure to a bortezomib-based regimen. And again, in these studies, bortezomib was also part of maintenance therapy after induction. It is possible to shorten the duration of induction therapy if a consolidation maintenance therapy is given after induction, because the patient is continuously exposed to a bortezomib-based regimen, and this translates into a progressive increase in the rate of complete response. And the issue of shifting from twice to a once-weekly bortezomib administration is particularly important in the setting of very elderly myeloma patients, that is, patients who are over 75 years of age. These patients probably do suffer mostly from neurological toxicity, and it is very important to reduce the risk of peripheral neuropathy with a once-weekly administration and eventually a lower dose of bortezomib.
What's happening to the role of transplantation in this new era with the novel agents coming on board?
At this time, my personal idea is that autologous stem cell transplantation still remains the standard of therapy for younger myeloma patients, or even for those patients who are transplant eligible. I mean patients aged between 65 and 70 years. As you know, in Europe, it is quite difficult to see a patient older than 70 receiving an autologous stem cell transplantation. By the opposite, in the US, patients 73 or 75 years old are submitted to and are proposed for an autologous stem cell transplantation. However, the main open question at this time is, in the novel agent era, autologous stem cell transplantation should be an upfront therapy, or it can be delayed at the time of relapse? And two, large clinical trials, one conducted in US and Europe. It is a joint venture by IFM and the Dana-Farber Group, and the other conducted by several European investigators, and I am one of the principal investigators of these trials, have been designed in order to prospectively address this question, that is, to compare an arm in which transplant is performed upfront with another arm in which novel agents are incorporated into treatment and transplant is reserved and is delayed at the time of relapse. The major endpoint is progression-free survival, and I'm not sure that we will be able to see any difference in terms of overall survival, because certainly a fraction of patients in which transplant have been delayed will receive transplant at the time of relapse. So probably overall survival curves might be superimposable. However, in terms of progression-free survival, in terms of duration of response, it is important to investigate whether transplant upfront gives a longer progression-free survival in comparison with a treatment not incorporating high-dose therapy and using a prolonged exposure to novel agents.
As you've sort of described this whole picture of, you know, managing myeloma, how does your overall thoughts about the disease vary when you deal with a patient with adverse cytogenetics?
I think that cytogenetic abnormalities probably at this time play the major role in terms of trying to better identifying the risk and the prognosis of the patient. So my personal recommendation is to perform a cytogenetic analysis, an analysis by FISH, in the highest number of patients is possible. And it is important not only to evaluate the cytogenetic profile at the time of diagnosis, but also to reevaluate the presence or absence of cytogenetic abnormalities at the time of relapse, at least in those patients who at the time of diagnosis had no specific abnormalities. And this is very important because it is the way to try to tailor in the near future a therapy according to the cytogenetic profile of the single patient. At this time, probably we are not ready to tailor treatment according to cytogenetic abnormalities, although we have several data showing that several of the novel agents are able to overcome the poor prognosis, which is related to some of these abnormalities. However, we certainly need to furtherly increase our knowledge in this setting.
So I'd like to go through your cases. Let's talk about your first patient, a 55-year-old, speaking of adverse cytogenetics.
Yeah, this was a patient age 55. He had an advanced ISS clinical stage at the time of diagnosis, and the FISH analysis demonstrated the presence of 13q deletion and translocation T414. This is a young patient who is transplant eligible. So the first question is, which newer induction regimen should be used in preparation for autologous stem cell transplantation? I certainly do not recommend a thalidomide-based regimen because there is proof that thalidomide is not able to overcome the adverse prognosis related to T414 translocation. At this time, we have quite robust data showing that a bortezomib-based regimen is able to overcome, at least in part, the intermediate prognosis, which is related to T414, because as you know, the highest risk is related to the presence of 17p deletion. The role of lenalidomide is at this time quite controversial. Several studies do suggest that it is able to overcome the poor prognosis. Others are quite conflicting. So at this time, I might recommend that a patient with a T414 translocation should receive an induction therapy with a 3-drug regimen incorporating bortezomib. The other partner may be thalidomide or may be lenalidomide or cyclophosphamide, as we discussed before. However, I think that these patients might have benefit from a bortezomib-based regimen. Results of a French study and of an Italian study conducted by the GMEMA show that the progression-free survival advantage for patients receiving VTD and double autologous stem cell transplantation in comparison with thalidomide dexamethasone and tandem transplant was maintained across all subgroup of patients with poor prognosis, including those with T414 translocation.
So what happened with this patient?
This patient is currently in CR 3 years after transplant.
So what was the exact treatment that he received?
He received a VTD induction, 3 21-day cycles, followed by tandem transplant, and then again VTD as post-transplant consolidation.
And for how long did he get the consolidation?
The consolidation comprised 2 35-day days of VTD, was for approximately 70 days after transplant.
What was his status at diagnosis? How much bone disease did he have? Did he have renal dysfunction? What were the problems when he was diagnosed, and what happens with treatment?
He had a normal renal function. However, even if this patient had an impaired renal function, the choice of using a bortezomib-based regimen should be a good choice because, as you know, bortezomib is not excreted through the kidneys. It does not require a dose modification. This occurs also for thalidomide. However, the major issue in patients with renal failure is that the recovery of a normal renal function is strictly related to the quality of response. This means that if you use a bortezomib-based regimen, which is able to increase the rate of a complete response in comparison with a thalidomide-based regimen, you are also potentially able to normalize the renal function. You can also use lenalidomide in patients with renal failure. However, it is important to reduce the dose of the drug accordingly to the degree of renal impairment. It is possible to use lenalidomide. However, due to the fact that bortezomib is not excreted through the kidneys and that it works through inhibiting nuclear factor Kb and reducing the inflammatory proteins which contribute to the renal damage, I think that at this time, bortezomib-based regimen is the treatment of choice in a patient with impaired renal function. Although, as I mentioned before, lenalidomide is not excluded. It may be applied.
What was the status of this man's bones at diagnosis? What bisphosphonate, if any, did he get, and for how long?
I think that the correct approach is to start bisphosphonate along with the start of induction therapy and then to prolong bisphosphonate. Bisphosphonate should be given for not more than 2 years because all the studies so far conducted have been conducted for a maximum length of 2 years. In other words, there is no proof that over 2 years there is any benefit. It is also possible, especially in the novel agent era, to reduce the treatment exposure to bisphosphonate, and if the patient achieves a complete response within a relatively short time period, to stop bisphosphonate administration after 1 year from the start of treatment, because probably in the setting of patients in complete response, the mechanism underlying bone resorption are completely different from those who are present at the time of diagnosis. So it might be that a prolonged exposure might not be of beneficial value. Although we have no data coming from phase 3 clinical trials in which patients were randomized to receive bisphosphonate for a single year versus 2 years in terms of complete response. However, several guidelines do suggest that a patient in CR should stop bisphosphonate after 1 year.
I wanted to ask you about your 77-year-old patient and maybe kind of get into what we were talking before about over age 75.
Yes, this is a patient who was age 77 years. He received a first-line therapy with a combination of bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, that is MPV, as first-line therapy, achieved a very good partial response and had a progressive disease with a symptomatic myeloma after 22 months from starting MPV. And in these patients, the major issue is which type of second-line therapy should I use? It is important to remind that a patient at the time of relapse should be treated only if there is the proof of an organ damage. The concept is the same at the start of induction. In other terms, a patient who moves from a negative immunofixation to a positive immunofixation, but who maintain a normal hemoglobin level, normal renal function, who has not progressive skeletal disease, should not be treated. He should stay on follow-up without any therapy. The patient should receive salvage therapy only if the disease is symptomatic, only if there is an organ damage. Coming back to the choice of second-line therapy, I think that an important issue which was derived from the VISTA trial and expanded follow-up is related to the fact that patients relapsing after a quite long time period should be rechallenged and should respond equally well to a bortezomib-based regimen. So in other terms, in a patient who remain in at least a VCPR for approximately 24 months, that is a time period exceeding the median time to progression, which was originally seen in the registrative study, it might be a good option to reinstitute the same induction therapy. Otherwise, you can move to another class of agent and, for example, you can use lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Regarding the use of dexamethasone in the elderly myeloma population, it is important to remind the results of an ECOG study in which lenalidomide plus high-dose dexamethasone was compared with lenalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone. And in this study, it was clearly demonstrated that at least in the elderly myeloma population, high-dose dexamethasone is detrimental. So in this patient population, the ideal schema is to use Dex at the dose of 40 milligram every week.
So what actually happened with this man?
He received again MPV. He responded very well. You should remind that at this time, although the landscape is very promising, we have three major agents. I think that hopefully within a relatively short time period, we will be able to enjoy carfilzomib or pomalidomide and other agents. However, at this time, we have three major drugs. So an important issue is to try to maintain a drug to which the patient was not exposed in the case of progressive disease not responding to previous therapy. So my choice was to try to retreat him with the same regimen to which he responded favorably at the time of relapse. And this was based on two major issues. The first one is the positive response to induction therapy, and the second one is the relatively long duration of response. And in these patients, in at least 50 or even 70% of these patients, a retreatment with bortezomib, a bortezomib-based regimen, is able to reinduce a good response status. And this happened with this patient, who at this time has a very little minimal residual disease, and he is actually receiving bortezomib biweekly as maintenance therapy.
And how long has it been since he was treated the second time?
Approximately 16 months.
Wow. So what happened with this particular man with the first treatment and the second treatment in terms of side effects and particularly neuropathy?
When I retreated him with MPV, I used a once weekly administration of bortezomib. This was not the case of induction therapy because at the time the VISTA trial and MPV with twice weekly administration was the standard of care. And with the once weekly administration, the risk of neurological toxicity was very low, is very low, below 5%. And if you use a maintenance with bortezomib given every 2 weeks, the risk of neurological toxicity is negligible. Again, it is important to reduce the dose of the drug accordingly to the treatment phase and the disease phase of the patient, accordingly to the age, and to try to reduce as much as possible toxicity and adverse events.
So did this man have neuropathy the first time he was treated with the biweekly schedule?
He had neuropathy, but after appropriate dose reduction of bortezomib, neuropathy resolved.
And the second time when you treated him weekly, he did not have neuropathy?
He did not have neuropathy.
He sounds like he's an experiment or a trial in and of himself.
Yeah, sure.
What do you say to patients and what do you have your staff say to patients for beginning bortezomib in terms of what to expect and when to call you in terms of neuropathy symptoms? And what did you say to this man?
I think that with an agent such as bortezomib, it is very important to clearly explain to the patients the symptoms and the side effects which might be related to bortezomib, and to advise the patients that at the first onset of one of these symptoms, he should call the doctor and should ask for a visit. It is important to see these patients quite frequently, because if you see them quite frequently, you are able to appropriately reduce the dose or even to stop the treatment. And in the case of neurological toxicity, this is mandatory in order to have a resolution or a decrease in the grade of neurological toxicity. If you go on, neurological toxicity can only progress.